the first day of Christmas, my true love gave to me a partridge in a pear tree. On the second day of Christmas, my true love gave to me two turtle doves and a partridge in a pear tree. On the third day of Christmas...
Hi, welcome to this week's program. Well, it's that time of the year again, the time of the year where I like to cover PNC Bank's tongue-in-cheek Christmas Price Index. This is where they track prices of the basket of goods mentioned in the holiday classic, The 12 Days of Christmas. You know, the one that goes on the first day of Christmas, my true love sent to me, partridge in a pear tree, and so on. So I know you know what I'm talking about. So we're going to be talking about 11 pipers piping and 10 lords a-leaping. So here we go. PNC compiles prices of what these gifts cost true loves every year. In 2017, PNC Wealth Management found that the cost of all these gifts, they call it the Total Christmas Price Index, was $34,558.65, which was up 0.6% over last year. Not much of an increase, that's for sure. However, looking back 5 years, this quirky basket of swans and leaping lords costs 15% more. Looking back 10 years, it costs 52% more. So how did this quirky index get started? Well, it was started by the chief economist at PNC predecessor bank in Philadelphia in 1984. Since then, the index has averaged an annual year-over-year price increase of 1.9%, which is less than the 2.67% of the real consumer price index. So what drives the prices of these gifts? PNC's Christmas Index broadly mirrors economic conditions, which they've broken down into three main drivers of change over the past 34 years. It should be no surprise that the biggest driver is the internet. With the internet ever more ubiquitous, it's even easier than ever to find these items online. However, these gifts tend to be more expensive due to the additional costs in shipping and handling, and the prices that I'm going to mention here do not include shipping and handling. Coming in second is the price of services increasing, though price of goods themselves have slowed. And finally, the cost of fuel has been especially volatile over the few years, having a big effect on the cost of shipping. Now, a lot of last year's items stayed at the same price. The cost of French hens, the cost of calling birds, geese, swans, and maids a-milking, so that's the employed. Also, other employed people would include dancing ladies. They're not making much more money this year due to the well-known fact that wages have been stagnating. There is an exception, however. Lords a-leaping have been on a steady increase. That's up 2% this year for a total of $5,618.90. So there hasn't been a lot of price jumps and no price drops. So what category has had the highest jump in price? It's turtle doves. In 2016, turtle doves went up a whopping 29.3% and cost $375 a pair. Luckily, things have leveled off and stayed the same price this year. 2017 brings us gold as the winner, with 5 gold rings up 10% due to an increase in demand and popularity. Partridges in a pear tree came in right behind with a 4.7% increase. That's not due to the partridge, however, it's the pear tree has increased due to the rise in the cost of living for workers, not their wages, the cost of living for workers, and a limited supply of mature trees. Now, this is interesting because in 2016, the biggest loser was both the partridge and the pear tree, with partridges down by 20% and pear trees cost the same. That led to a 2.3% decline in price in 2016, so they've rebounded. And drumroll, please, the most expensive item on the list is still the 7 swans a-swimming. No increase or decrease in price, which is good because they're still costing a whopping $13,125 to acquire for your true love. Now, the Christmas Index comes with its own website, PNCChristmasPriceIndex.com, and has been developed as an interactive experience so educators can explain economic trends to middle and high school students. That's pretty cool and a great idea. So if you're really curious about how the prices of maids a-milking or lords a-leaping have changed over the years, head over to the website for more details, PNCChristmasPriceIndex.com. All right, so here's 5 golden rules for holiday shopping. I'm going to be quick on this. First, be choosy. pare down your list to those that are really close to you. Don't get guilt-trapped into buying gifts for faraway relatives and long-forgotten friends that you're not in touch with anymore. Instead, you could just send them an e-card or a long email with photo attachments, updating them on what's been going on and how your family has been doing and how they've grown. Also, try to create a budget. I think very few people actually do this, but I think it's a good idea. Once you've narrowed down your list, decide how much you will spend per person, keep it reasonable, and stick to your budget. Of course, find bargains. There's a lot of smart deals online with coupons, free shipping, no-hassle returns, and there's always Black Friday, Cyber Monday, etc., so take advantage of those promotions. Also, for those of you who like to be crafty, you could save a ton if you plan and make gifts ahead of time. Knitted scarves, homemade cookies, millions of gift ideas you can find on the internet. You know, a personal touch is always warmly received, provided you put a little thought and effort into the making. You could also get creative and swap gifts for donations to the gift receiver's charity, or schedule a date such as a show or a movie so you can get your family time with your loved ones. Donations also reinforce charitable giving with kids and give them a chance to appreciate the things that they have in life. And finally, pay smartly. This is a great time to cash in your credit card rewards or gift cards or gifts. Consider using prepaid cards so you can stick to a budget if you need to do that. But if you use credit cards, make sure you have a plan to pay off your balance right away, because the interest can really add up, and that's really a bad thing. So if you pay your balance every month, get the card with the most generous points, miles, or cashback features that fit your lifestyle. If you're shopping online also, here's a tip. Make sure you're shopping at a secure website where the page has a lock icon on it and a web address that starts with HTTPS, where S stands for secure. So have a wonderful time this holiday season. Have a terrific new year. Enjoy every day of this most joyous holiday.
A milking,
seven swans a swimming,
six geese a laying,
five golden rings, four calling birds, three French hens,
two turtle doves,
and a partridge in a pear tree.
This week on the All in the Money Minute, some of my best tips this year. Hi, this is Steve Pomerantz with today's On the Money Minute. All this week, I'm going to break format a bit. I'm going to mix it up and share what I consider to be my best tips I've mentioned during the On the Money Minute. My first advice today is about owning bonds. Most major discount brokerage firms offer government, corporate, and other bonds. But depending on the size of your portfolio and tax bracket, you may want to use a good tax yield equivalent calculator to see if muni bonds are more advantageous. You want to get good advice on this because insured bonds are no longer as safe as previously believed, and the municipal market is no longer a simple place to invest. However, in general, municipal bonds are a very safe investment, so they should be carefully considered. Want more on the money? Don't forget to follow us at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com, or facebook.com/The Steve Pomeranz Show. This is not a show about politics, and it will never be. And I know my listeners know that. Today's show is not about politics, but to a degree, it is about Donald Trump. Well, not really. It's really about the art of persuasion. And my next guest, who most of you will know by his work, considers himself an expert in this particular art. Another thing that you probably won't know is that in August of 2015, contrary to nearly every prediction at the time, he predicted that Donald Trump had a 98% chance of winning the presidency of the United States. So what does this have to do with the art of persuasion? Let's find out. I'm going to welcome Scott Adams. Scott is the creator of one of the most popular cartoons of all time, Dilbert, and he's the author of numerous books, the latest one being the one we're going to talk about today, and its title is Win Bigly, Persuasion in a World Where Facts Don't Matter, and I'm very, very happy to have Scott on my show. Hey, Scott, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So to make it clear, what are your politics and your policies of, do you agree, disagree? Where are you on the Trump versus the world map?
Well, I don't identify with either Republicans or Democrats. I call myself ultra-liberal, meaning I'm so liberal that liberals don't recognize me. And the big difference is that, you know, I like all the stuff that Bernie likes, you know, free college and, you know, wouldn't it be great to have health care for everybody? But I don't know how to get there by raising taxes. Mm-hmm. So I'd rather get there with technical and systems improvements.
Okay.
So I don't really map to any of the big parties.
Okay. So what did you see in Donald Trump that caught your attention?
Well, I'm a trained hypnotist. So years ago, I learned the art of hypnosis and became a certified hypnotist. And since then, I've been studying all the various ways of persuasion. There are lots of different, you know, elements of that. And I noticed fairly early on that candidate Trump had a set of persuasion skills, actual, you know, technique that is stronger than anything I've ever seen in public. And I based my prediction not on his politics, not on the policies, not on his populism or any of that, but based on his pure ability to persuade.
Yeah. What does someone who studies or practices hypnosis know about the art of persuasion? How are those two connected?
So hypnosis is one corner of persuasion. It's just a small part of the larger picture. But what we learned as hypnotists is that the world that most people see is backwards. And specifically, people, the normal people, see the world as logical people who look at data, they look at facts, and then they try to arrive at decisions. Sure, we don't get it right all the time, but it's still a logical process. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while, maybe 10% of the time, yeah, we get a little crazy, but those are the exceptions. So that's the normal view of the world.
Yeah.
The hypnotist's view of the world is the opposite of that. The hypnotist sees people as rationalizing things they wanted to do for irrational reasons.
How did they come to that conclusion, though? I don't really see that. How did they come to that?
Well, let me just give you some context. When I was taking hypnosis, the hypnotist who taught the class said, don't look to the science for this, and you don't need to have any belief. So it's not about magic. It's not about science. We just observe over time that if we approach things this way, we get a good result. So you should look for that too. Just approach things this way mm-hmm. and watch what happens, see if it works. Now, since then, science has done a good job of confirming that people do not make decisions for rational reasons. We only think we do. So there are a lot of great books that have tons of science in them. If you wanted to read the book Influence by Robert Cialdini or his newer one, Persuasion, mm-hmm. or if you want to see Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Small,
right.
or the book Habit, or the book Nudge. So right now there are lots of popular books, and all of them refer to hard science that is all in the same direction. It all proves that humans are not rational creatures. We're only creatures who believe we're rational.
Okay. Well, if most people think they're rational 90% of the time and irrational 10, and the reality is the opposite, that's a huge disparity. So how does a master persuader use this dissonance, or this, I guess we call it cognitive dissonance, to move his target in the desired direction?
Well, I'll give you some examples. When Hillary Clinton was trying to do her persuasion, she started off with her resume and saying, I'm qualified, I've done a lot of things that are relevant to the job, and here are my policies, and my policies are good. What she didn't understand, and apparently she had no advisors with her at that point, to tell her that people don't make decisions on those things. They only think they do. It's an illusion that people care about policies as much as you think they do. Now, they do care, but not nearly as much as you think. Whereas President Trump was saying stuff like, let's build a wall, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was a visual persuasion. It had an emotional hook. People cared about the issue. We could see it. He made us think past the sale to what kind of a wall it would be and to who would pay for the wall. Now, making somebody think past the sale, which means to get them to think what would happen after the decision.
Yeah.
So the decision in that case was, do we build a wall or not? But he was making us think past that to who would pay for it. That is a classic and a very strong persuasion technique. Car salesmen use it all the time. So if your car salesman says to you, do you want the blue one or the white one?
Yeah.
The salesman is trying to get you to think past the decision of buying it so that you uncritically sort of commit to buying it before you have actually decided. So those are just two examples. But you can see right down the line that candidate Clinton was using the worst types of persuasion techniques, facts, logic, policies. And today, we can barely remember what any of her policies even were. They were forgettable. Mm-hmm. But you certainly remember almost everything that President Trump said, because he had a way of making it simple, repeatable, visual, provocative. And one of the things he does, especially on Twitter and in his rally speeches, is he'll inject some wrongness that you recognize as being wrong. It's mm-hmm. a little bit too provocative. He's gone too far this time. In fact, that's something you hear a lot, especially recently.
We're still seeing it. I mean, to this day, every single week, there is another announcement or something written in Twitter that gets everybody up in arms.
Yeah, and there's a lot of technique in that, because what it causes is for people to focus on whatever he wants you to focus on while you're criticizing him for being so provocative. Mm-hmm. And as long as he has your mind thinking about the stuff he wants you to think about, then he's got a persuasion advantage. So, for example, when he tweeted some videos of Muslim crimes against what looked on the videos to be non-Muslims, it didn't really matter if the videos were real. It didn't matter if they were actually what they seemed to present. What he was trying to do was persuade you to think that unless we have strong immigration, there would be problems of this nature coming to this country. Now, the facts, the logic, the how well do you vet, which countries are you talking about, surely you can't mean all Muslims, which he doesn't. But all of these questions came into play, and people kept thinking about these visuals of the Muslim violence as portrayed in these three videos. And the net of it is that emotionally, we feel like there's more danger than we felt before. So, and that's really all he's going for.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, your book title says, A World Where Facts Don't Matter. And the master persuader has this ability to create imagery, go past the sale, as you say. And yet, we all want reality to be facts. And yet, you're saying that we live in an irrational world where facts don't matter. This is a complete disparity or dissonance in our brains going on all the time.
Yeah, let me clarify that. When I say facts don't matter, I mean that people don't use them to make decisions. They certainly matter in terms of the real world effects. So in terms of the outcomes, all that matters is the facts. Mm-hmm. But we don't use them to make decisions, and there's plenty of science to back that up at this point.
Okay, let's move on. Let's talk about this idea of confirmation bias. So I found this definition. Confirmation bias is the tendency to interpret information in a way that confirms one's own preconceptions. How do you describe it in the way you're a master persuader, sees the world and uses it to their own benefit?
Yeah, so as your definition said, people tend to interpret all new information as supporting the opinion they already had. People rarely change their opinion. And we can see that with any major national election, that you get about half the people on each side, it's roughly split down the middle, no matter who's running and no matter what policies they're suggesting. So it's an illusion that people are looking at the policies. They are instead looking at all new information as, oh yeah, that certainly fits the story that I'd like it to fit. You've probably seen some of the funny street interviews that a number of people did. I think Jimmy Kimmel did, mm-hmm. in which a person with a microphone will stop someone in the street and present one candidate's policy as actually coming from the other candidate,
right?
Just to see if it will change their minds, thinking it comes from another candidate. And people will reinterpret any policy as being a good idea if they think it came from their candidate. And that effect is very strong.
Well, you wrote in the book that you tweeted one of Obama's speeches, I think it was 2012 or something, and you asked someone to send it to a known Trump follower and get an opinion. Can you just describe that quickly?
Yeah, I think that was the case of someone sending a Trump speech to an Obama supporter and telling him it was an Obama speech. And then, of course, it was just the greatest speech ever.
Yeah, I got it right here. Hold on a second. Page 45 was President Trump's inauguration speech, and he showed it to a leftist friend saying it was Obama's speech. My bad on that. So, and he said his friend loved it.
Yeah.
So that's confirmation bias?
Yes. And so you can reproduce this test with anybody who has a strong opinion of who they want to vote for, but doesn't know a lot about the topics. Just present anything from the other camp and say, what do you think of this? It's your candidate's opinion. And you'll find people say, yeah, that sounds pretty good to me, even if it's the opposite person's opinion.
My guest is Scott Adams. He is the creator of Dilbert and author of numerous books. And we're talking about his latest book, Win Bigly, Persuasion in a World Where Facts Don't Matter. And we'll be back with Scott in a moment. Are there any topics we're missing, guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show, questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomeranz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomeranz Show, and I'm Steve Pomeranz. We're back with Scott Adams. Scott, of course, is the cartoonist of Dilbert, and we're talking about his book, Win Bigly, Persuasion in a World Where Facts Don't Matter. So, Scott, I want you to deconstruct the tactics Trump used to persuade his way into the White House. Give us some ideas.
Well, my favorite examples are what I called his linguistic kill shots. Now, people are very familiar with them now, but remember at the beginning of the campaign, they were provocative and people were scratching their head. Why is he tweeting that Jeb Bush is low energy Jeb? Mm-hmm. But the day that I saw that, the first day, I said publicly, that's the end of the Jeb Bush campaign. And it turns out you could map it to that day. That was pretty much the end of him. And the reason was that I could see that his nickname was far more than just a casual insult, that it was engineered with the tools of persuasion. And specifically what he did was he reframed Jeb from what I think most people, including me, when we looked at Jeb Bush, we saw this cool, collected, executive type personality, exactly the person you'd want if you had a national crisis. Man, this person is cool. He's got it together. But the moment that Trump redefined him as low energy, you couldn't stop seeing that. It became instant and it was sticky. Mm. And it was reinforced every time you saw either Jeb do something that was normally his low energy Jeb persona versus Trump's high energy campaign and his rallies. You know, you saw this huge contrast, so that became sticky.
Is this the same as Crooked Hillary or some of the other names? Is that all part of that?
Yeah, so if you look at the similar construction for the other ones that worked well. So Lion Ted Cruz, he put an apostrophe after the N in Lion, and that's a technique to make you pause and wonder why the apostrophe's there instead of the G, all right? So anything that's sort of an intentional wrongness, and you'll see this all over his persuasion, it's his best technique. Mm-hmm. It makes you pause, and then that's the thing you remember, and memory is what makes you think something is a priority. Mm. In other words, if you spend a lot of time talking about, let's say, shark attacks, suddenly you start thinking shark attacks are the biggest problem in the world, when really they're not.
Well, especially during Shark Week in ratings season, right?
Yeah, it gets worse then for sure.
Go ahead.
So with getting back to Lion Ted, Ted Cruz has this unfortunate face that looks like the kind of character, if you were a movie director, you would cast as the villain. He's sort of got beady eyes and, you know, he just has a look that makes you think, well, is he telling the truth or not? Mm-hmm. Now, let me be clear. I have nothing against Ted Cruz, and I have no idea if he tells the truth more or less than an average senator or politician. But he sort of looks like he might, which is the genius of the linguistic kill shot. And then you knew that because it was a political race, that all the politicians would be accused of lying or exaggerating at some point. Yeah. It's just built into the system. And then you would be reminded of the nickname again, same with Crooked Hillary.
So does it make the bully in the room or the person who's calling these names, does it somehow create a protection around them and it lifts them up out of that same fray? I mean, didn't the Democrats try to label Trump with a nickname as well?
Yeah, so you can see the advantage of technique because Trump's nicknames almost universally stuck. He did a few, you know, what I call A-B testing, where he tested a few things before settling on one. But the ones he settled on really stuck. Now, compare that to the poorly engineered attempts on the other side, where they tried to nickname him. One was they tried to nickname him, at least this was a lot of the followers, not the Clinton campaign, by the old Austrian original name for Trump, which was Drumpf, D-R-U-M-P, I don't know, F or something.
Yeah.
And the name itself was funny, and I guess it was meant to feel a little demeaning, except if you're the Democrat Party, your whole idea is inclusiveness and not calling people out for their ethnicity. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's sort of your thing. And that's exactly what they were doing to him. Mm-hmm. So it was completely off brand. It was forgettable. It had no technique whatsoever and disappeared. Mm-hmm. But their worst attempt was one of the operatives. We saw this on a hidden video from Project Veritas, was talking about trying to get Donald Duck going. Mm. So we'll call him Donald Duck because he's ducking his tax returns. Mm. He's ducking this question.
Yeah.
And the problem is Donald Duck is a lovable, universally loved character.
It's owned by Disney, too. I don't think they're going to appreciate it too much.
Right. So I had every problem you could have in a nickname.
Yeah.
Then they tried Dangerous Donald because, he's dangerous. He's going to blow up the world. But they didn't factor in the fact that his supporters wanted a dangerous candidate to drain the swamp and kill ISIS and, you know, do the things that had to be done. Mm-hmm. So you notice that none of Trump's nicknames could be turned around to a positive. But Dangerous Donald could be.
Yeah. Just recently, there was a clip of President Trump honoring some Native Indians, and he brought up Pocahontas.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, so I get that now from what you're telling us. You want to poke a hole in the fabric of reality, make you stop and think. Memory is a persuader. And now we're back thinking about Elizabeth Warren only as Pocahontas. You know, but it's so disrespectful to the moment. And it's fine. I don't care if he's selling cars or he's selling real estate. But as a president who's representing a whole country, I mean, is there a point where this persuasion, maybe it's incredibly effective, but it's just wrong?
There are a lot of rules that apply to President Trump that will probably never apply to any other candidate. And the reason that he can get away with stuff is that he has, first of all, a brand that specifically calls out not being politically correct. So as long as you're being consistent and on brand, people will give you a little bit more of a pass than if they see you operating in a way that seems counter to your own brand.
In other words, if we hear this enough, I mean, foreign leaders are seeing this, the world is seeing this from their own point of view and their own cultures, but if they see it enough, won't it eventually just become part of the fabric and not a pinpoint in it anymore?
Yes. And the way I describe it is my mother had this saying, she would say, you can get used to anything if you do it long enough, including hanging. And the idea is that if you see Trump acting this way long enough, it starts to look normal to you. And I think you're seeing that. So, for example, you notice that he'll have five provocative tweets that make CNN wonder if he's lost his mind and he's going crazy. And they'll be on silly issues about personalities, people he's poking. But then he'll have another tweet that might be about North Korea, and it's completely serious and just says, President Xi is doing something, we've got this. And you can see that he can change tones in a heartbeat. Mm. And now people are starting to understand that there's part of what he brings to politics that no one else ever has, and maybe nobody else ever will, which is the showman part. So he's actually bringing a sense of theater, a sense of the drama. But it's becoming a little more clear in people's minds, not everybody yet, but over time, people are starting to understand that some of it is just the show. And its point is to draw the attention to whatever he wants you to see.
And we can't help it. It's the car wreck syndrome.
Yes.
We can't help but slow down and look. This imagery, the lion Ted, the low energy this, the crooked Hillary, those are so powerful, but will they wear off over time?
Well, he operates in what I call a narrow band of wrongness, meaning that just about everything that you see in the news, he's doing something in that area that's a little bit unpresidential according to us.
Yes.
And yet, he's been doing this since the beginning of the campaign, and his results have been spectacular. Mm-hmm. He got the nomination against all odds, doing all of this stuff. He got the presidency against all odds, doing all of this stuff. And now we're watching the stock market at a high, consumer confidence up, a whole bunch of movement in, you know, international things that look positive, at least now. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody could predict the future. But it seems that time after time, he does what you're not supposed to do, but he gets a good result. And after some point, people are going to recognize the pattern.
The book is Win Bigly, Persuasion in a World Where Facts Don't Matter. The author is cartoonist of Dilbert Cartoons, Scott Adams. This is a book, if you want to learn how to persuade, you want to understand the psychology of persuasion and get some very good insights that we don't really have the time to explore here, I highly recommend this book. And don't forget to hear this discussion again, to read it again, to weigh in on this discussion. Join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. Scott, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, little boxes, little boxes all the same. There's a green one and a pink one, and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams in sunny Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
You know, you are in the studio today. This is so exciting.
Whoop, whoop.
So we get to look at each other and have some fun here today.
That's right.
That's wonderful. So a lot has been happening in the real estate market, and there was some news last week that new home sales surged unexpectedly to a 10-year high in October. What's going on?
You know, that's great news. It did rise unexpectedly in October, it actually hitting their highest level in 10 years amidst the robust demand across the country.
Robust demand. We got any kind of statistics with that number?
Actually, yes. The Commerce Department said on Monday that new home sales rose about 6.2% to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 685,000 units last month.
That sounds like a lot, 6.2%. I mean, I think it's been running at 2 to 3% or something like that. So there's been
a big jump.
So something's going on. Something is absolutely going on. And new home sales have now increased for 3 straight months.
That's right. So, this is all good news. This is actually going to help the housing shortage. You know, this has been a problem we've talked about for, you know, quite some time. So the market's starting to regain momentum after treading waters for, you know, quite some time. It's been constrained by just shortages of homes for sale.
Yeah, remember, we've been talking about that for ages.
Yeah, and in new construction, there's always problems trying to find property, land to build, and a shortage of workers.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that is good. Things are improving.
Well, I was thinking that maybe this was a rebound from the hurricanes of Harvey and Irma, but this is not. Those have been a constraint. So I think the indication is that maybe these numbers would have even been higher had it not been for the hurricane. So that's some healthy stuff going on.
Oh, absolutely. If you look at last month, new single home sales rose 30% in the Northeast.
Wow.
So that area wasn't hit by the hurricane.
30%.
And when you look at the South, that only increased 1.3%. So you can see the effect that the hurricane had in the on the new
home construction. So I guess maybe the 30% in the Northeast really pushed it up. Yeah. Okay. So in spite of all these new homes being sold, you'd think maybe that inventory would have shrunk, which has always been the problem, but that's not been the case, right?
No, I mean, well, despite the rise in sales in October, the inventory of new homes on the market actually increased 1.4% to actually the highest level since May of 2009.
I think what this tells me, you know, as someone who follows the economic markets very closely, is that the economy is strong. Real estate is now strong again and getting stronger. It's a very healthy cycle that we're starting to experience here. This is all very, very good news. Now, another thing that's increasing the sales of new homes, surprisingly, are millennials. I think finally, Terry, they're moving out of the basement.
What
do you think?
That's right. They are moving out of the basement. Studies are indicating that they are actually moving out of the basement. They are forming new household formations. They're moving into the suburbs. They're buying furniture. SUVs.
Are they becoming like us?
They are.
Oh my gosh.
What were we called? Double income.
Oh, no kids? No.
Yeah. Whatever.
Well, there's dinks. Double
dinks
income,
and,
no kids.
Right.
There's silks, which you don't want to be, which is single income, lots of kids.
So yeah, they're following in our footsteps.
Okay. Well, finally, I can say that. But here's something that's very unusual. So the millennials are buying new homes. They're moving out of apartments, buying new homes, you know, experiencing household formation and doing all the fun stuff. And empty nesters, their parents are doing what?
Now that the kids are out of the house, they're selling the house and they're moving into rentals.
They're moving into rentals.
They've been wanting to do this for a long time, but their millennial children have just kept them having to hold on to their homes.
Will he get out of the house already
so we
can downsize? So that's very interesting because, you know, I know in our area in Boca Raton and actually South Florida, there's new rental units going up like crazy. I know in downtown Boca, I mean, almost every other block, what they're building really are rental units.
You know, if you put things in perspective, if you look at years 2009 to 2015 in the 55-plus market, it increased 28% in rentals, while the millennials at 34-year-old, you know, age group only jumped up 3%. So you can see the huge differential. They're slowing down and 55 plus are moving on up.
Yeah, yeah. So empty nesters are looking for lower expenses. They're looking for less house-related work. We all understand this. I mean, you know, at a certain point, you really don't want to maybe mow the lawn anymore. You don't really want to be spending your weekends at the Home Depot. You want to be out on the golf course, you know? So it's a reversal that just comes through age demographics.
Yeah, and they get to pull their equity out of the homes and, you know, call you up and invest it.
That's right. We're going to talk about that in a minute, by the way. So for millennials that are now looking to buy a home, how do they know how much home they can buy with the earnings that they actually have?
You know, that's an excellent question. The first thing they really need to do is look at a budget. They have to take into consideration how much they're currently renting now, which, you know, with rent, it's kind of a straight line.
Mm-hmm.
You know what your payment is, you know what you can predict. But when you're owning a home, you have to take into factors property taxes.
Yeah.
Property taxes go up. You've got to be able to afford the increases. Homeowner insurance, that's something that also increases over time. Whether or not you have to take out PMI insurance, that's if you put down less than 20%, you incur private mortgage insurance.
Yeah.
And then you also have to take into consideration just the cost of maintaining the property, association fees, they go up.
You know, I always thought it was very cute. A couple once said to me a long time ago, they were a young couple, they said, we want to buy a house, we want to save money. You know, because there is this thinking that, you know, heck, I'm going to build equity over time. And that is true. But I can tell you guys, you know, anybody who's owned a house knows that it's a constant, you're constantly feeding your hard-earned money to keep
the
house going.
And there is the appreciation factor, and that's what you're banking on.
Yeah.
So your monthly outflow can be a little higher in a single family home.
Yeah.
Although right now, statistically, they'll tell you it's cheaper to buy a house because the cost of rent is high.
It's high.
But it all just depends on what your long-term goals are.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, there are a lot of costs associated with owning a home. You have to be prepared to be able to pay for those things.
That's right, right. Well, we're out of time. My guest, as always, is Terry Story. Terry is a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
SteVePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, PomeranZ.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. The new tax bill is coming at us like a freight train, so it's time to get down to brass tacks and see how it affects us all. You know, I told that to my production assistant, and she doesn't think it's very funny. All right, Tony Nitti joins me today. He's a tax partner with Withum, Smith & Brown's National Tax Service Group. He's a CPA licensed in Colorado and New Jersey and holds a master's in taxation from the University of Denver. And lastly, and perhaps most notably, he once sang the national anthem at the World Series baseball game, though he was not at the vicinity of the microphone at the time. With that, I welcome Tony Nitti. Hey, Tony, welcome to the show.
Steve, thank you so much for having me.
So I understand you're joining us from New York today. Weather cold enough for you?
Yeah, I'm from Colorado, so this is actually fairly balmy for me.
That's cool. Hey, you know, these tax plans are preliminary as we record this because the bill has not really been passed, but two versions have been passed. What do they look like from an individual's point of view?
Well, there are a lot of kind of big picture items are very, very similar. There are a couple key differences, but what we're after here from both the House and Senate bills is individual tax cuts. However, right, they're going to be coupled with the elimination of a lot of deductions. And so what we're really looking at is more what they refer to as tax reform. So adding some simplicity to the law.
Okay.
An example would just be, you know, we're going to reduce individual tax rates. We're going to double the standard deduction. And then we're going to eliminate a bunch of the old tried and true itemized deductions people love, whether it's medical expenses, state and local income taxes. And that means you're inherently going to create some winners and losers where, you know, some people may have an immediate tax increase. A lot of people are going to have a cut. But the idea is you're not just lowering tax rates, you're leaving the tax law a little bit more easy to manage than it has been in the past.
All right, let me ask you this question. So let's take the standard deduction. If you're married, it's doubled from $12,000 to $24,000. So that's another $12,000 dollars that you don't have to pay tax on. Am I incorrect in saying that if my tax, state and city taxes are $12,000, then that's a wash? Because I won't be able to deduct the state and city taxes. That's what I meant.
That's exactly right. I mean, so the standard deduction being doubled really accomplishes two things. Number one, for low-income taxpayers, it removes more people from the tax rolls simply because, as you alluded to, they're going to have $24,000 of income before they're forced to pay any tax now as compared to a smaller amount under current law.
Right.
But for everybody else, it just means that, you know, whether or not you benefit from those standard deductions is going to depend what the sum of your itemized deductions are. And if you're someone that typically has a large amount of mortgage interest or real estate taxes, you're not going to benefit from the doubling of the standard.
Yeah.
Now, other itemized deductions are going to be eliminated so that it looks like about 94% of the population will actually take the standard next year under either of these bills, mm-hmm. which there's no arguing that creates some simplicity, right? Yeah, if more people are taking the standard,
yeah.
they'll feel like they can prepare their own return. And that's certainly a step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. What about charitable gifting? Has that been changed at all?
You know, it's actually one of the only things that kind of emerges from both these bills unscathed. And so not only has it really not been changed, it's actually been enhanced a little bit, where we used to be limited. We could only give, you know, cash contributions to a charity up to 50% of what's called our adjusted gross income. Mm-hmm. That threshold will actually be increased to 60%. So okay. charitable contributions, I should say, are really one of the few itemized deductions that kind of dodged the bullet here.
So in a sense, charitable organizations to a smaller degree can be one of the winners in this process.
Yeah, that's kind of the funny thing here, Steve, is, you know, tax reform by its nature creates winners and losers, but sometimes people that we would think would be the winners perceive themselves to be losers, and charitable organizations are a great example of that, because here you have donations coming out of this largely unscathed, but yet the charitable organizations are furious about these two bills because, what did I say, right? 94% of people won't itemize going forward, and charitable contributions are itemized deductions. And so, not to say that people only give to charity to gain a tax break, but it certainly doesn't hurt. And mm-hmm. as year end approaches, people who want a tax deduction, they start cutting checks to the yeah. church or whoever it may be.
Got your point.
And now if those 94% of people realize they're not going to get any benefit for cutting those checks, maybe that checkbook goes right back into the drawer.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go on to some other features. The estate tax exemption went from about $5 million, it got doubled to $11 million. So the first $11 million of your estate is not subject to tax. I know the Republicans seem to want to eliminate the estate tax, and they've done something with this over the years. What happens?
So the House and Senate kind of take a different tack here. The House, as you said, would certainly double the exemption right off the bat to $11 million, $22 million if you're married. But then the House would take the added step in year six of completely eliminating the estate tax, mm-hmm. whereas the Senate would double the estate tax exemption as the House did, but never take that second step of completely repealing it. And in fact, you talk about a twist here. For the Senate bill to comply with these budget rules, every single individual change, whether it's tax cuts or change deductions or even the estate tax, under the Senate bill will expire December 31st, 2025. And so the estate tax, if nothing were to change between now and the end of 2025, would actually, you know, the exemptions would kick back to where they are under current law, which is half of what they're moving to. So,
okay. Well, let's not get too complicated, because not too many people are going to be worrying about that. For now, I want to get to the tax rates or levels themselves. There's the highest tax bracket is 39.6. I think that gets slightly lowered. Take us through the two versions as simply as possible. One version has 7, one version has 4. Where do they kind of overlap, and what does this mean to the middle class person?
Sure. Well, first, you know, current law, just establishing a baseline, we've got 7 rates, and they go from 10% to 39.6%. Mm-hmm. The House bill would kind of embrace a long-held Republican ethos that fewer brackets are better, and so they would leave us with 4 rates, going from 12% and keeping that 39.6% top rate, but really limiting it to a much higher level of income. So you'd have to make more than $500,000 if you're single, $1 million if you're married. Mm-hmm. And then the Senate bill would keep 7 rates like we have under current law, but reduce that top rate and some of the lower rates too, but the top rate from 39.6% to 38.5%. And so when you ask about the middle class, there's no huge, you know, marginal drop in rates for middle class taxpayers, but because all of the rates along the way are being lowered, there will be some immediate benefit given out to most taxpayers.
According to this chart I'm looking at, if you make between $60,000 and $93,700, the current tax rate is 25%, the House tax rate is 25%, and the Senate tax rate is 25%. So I guess if you add in the standard deduction and you don't live in a high tax state or city, are you probably going to see a benefit?
Well, sure, particularly because your lower brackets will be reduced as well. Yeah, so, yeah. You know, a 15% bracket becomes a 12% bracket and things like that. So you're absolutely right.
So there is some money, again, for those people that are not in high tax states, there is some money that they're going to get back or some amount of reduced tax.
Yes, particularly in year one.
Okay.
You know, tax law can get a little tricky because to use the process the Republican tax writers used here, they had to comply with, again, kind of a complicated process. But that's why we see things expire over the 10-year period. Mm-hmm. And so the people who get cuts in year one, what we're finding is that a lot of those people may not still be getting cuts in year 10.
So has this plan become simpler or more complex?
You know, that's a great question, and I think it depends on who you really zero in on. On the lower income side of things, you absolutely get some much needed simplicity in the form of the doubled standard deduction, without question, right? Mm-hmm. That's a 27 million more taxpayers that won't have to go through shoeboxes full of charitable contribution receipts or medical expense deductions. So that's nice simplicity. For the more sophisticated higher income tax clients, I think we've got a great deal of complexity being layered on top of what is already a very complex body of law. And so I think the people who really become excited about these two proposals are the tax lawyers and the tax accountants who are going to be working in this law for the next 10 years.
Yeah, so much for the flat tax idea and, you know, to eliminate all the complexity. All right, let's move to corporations. Now, a lot of small businesses form a corporation as an S corporation. And can you just take a moment to explain what an S corporation is?
Yeah, sure. In very simple terms, a C corporation, or what we call a regular corporation, is subject to tax twice. When the C corp earns the income, it's taxed. And then when the C corp distributes the income, the shareholder pays tax a second time. If you make this election to be taxed as an S corporation, then you're only subject to one level of tax, which is hugely advantageous. So now, if an S corp generates income, there is no tax at the S corp level. Instead, the income, quote unquote, flows through to the owner, and the owner pays the tax at the individual level. So you escape double taxation. So it's very, very appealing.
All right. So if I owned a small business, let's say I owned a clothing store or some kind of small manufacturing company, and I was an S corp, you know, I had maybe, you know, 10 employees or, you know, relatively small, and all the excess earnings would flow through to me at the end of the day, and then my tax bracket then would apply. Now, what is the change in the tax bracket now for these pass-through or these S corporations?
Well, that's a question that could take anywhere from 4 to 8 hours to answer based on what we're seeing here in the House and Senate bills. But the idea is, because the regular corporate tax rate is being reduced, they had to do something for owners of S corporations and partnerships as well to keep them kind of on equal footing. But they went about it in different ways. The House would effectively say the highest tax rate you could pay on your income from an S corporate partnership will be 25%. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of exceptions to that, which make it very, very difficult, in fact, to get that 25% rate.
Okay.
And then the Senate bill would say, we're not going to give you a flat rate. Instead, whatever income you get from your S corporate partnership, you can take a deduction equal to 23% of that income. Again, and that's replete with its own set of limitations and phase outs and complexity.
Okay. All right. Look, you sang the national anthem at a World Series baseball game. Give me a number, because I didn't really, it's too complex what you just told me.
Yep.
So what are we talking about? 30% maybe? Is there a number we can hang a hat on?
Yeah, let's do it this way. Under the House bill, most businesses, owners, you'll be paying around 35% at a top rate, I should say, a top rate of 35%. Uh-huh. And then under the Senate bill, you pay a top rate of under 30%, about 29%.
Okay, good. So are there any S corp, like service industries, lawyers and the like, that are excluded from this bill, or is this applied to everybody?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, the only universal loser as far as industry goes between the House and Senate bills and the treatment of this S-corp partnership type income are people in personal service businesses. So if you're an accountant, a lawyer, consultant, et cetera, you are not eligible for either the 25% rate under the House bill or the deduction under the Senate bill. So you're just paying tax at normal rates the way you always did.
So tax lawyers will have more business, but they're not going to get a benefit from lower taxes. That's kind of one thing to say, right?
Isn't that the beauty of it, right? As a tax accountant, I am thrilled by these changes because
I bet you are.
I love the complexity because I know it's going to keep me busy. But as a taxpayer, I am not particularly happy.
We are running out of time, but I did want to go over one of the winners, and that was the rental real estate owners. I didn't know this, and I saw this in your material. Why do people who own rental real estate benefit from this new law?
Well, under the House bill, remember when I said it's going to be hard for flow-through owners to get that 25% top rate? The easiest way to get it is on your rental income. So under the House bill, most rental income will be absolutely favored and get this 25% rate. Under the Senate bill, while you may not get that particular advantage, depreciation lives are going to come down. The ability to deduct all your interest expense will come down while it's going to be limited for other taxpayers. There's going to be additional changes where you can still do like-kind exchanges of real property, whereas everyone else is going to be shut out. Mm-hmm. So yeah, in both bills, owning real estate is, you know, a great position to be in going forward.
Thank you. My guest, Tony Nitti, is a tax partner with Witham, Smith & Brown's National Tax Group Service, and he joins me today from New York. And to hear this discussion again, to read it, to weigh in with your opinion, and to share it with your friends, don't forget to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. Hey, Tony, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
You know, I just want to remind you that any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.